So what do you remember about 2017?
I certainly remember the feeling that actually my character discusses in the beginning of the play, that at the onset of his administration and the onset of all the horrors he started to enact, that the feeling of like, well, this is gonna, something's gonna bring him down because there's no way that this is tolerable.
I remember watching these hearings, like if I didn't watch them, then they wouldn't happen and somehow they wouldn't have an impact. And at the same time, I also remember thinking, it has to get better. Like, this can't last. Things are going to break down and he will be called out.
I just remember feeling like, oh my God, let this be it. Let this be the thing that sinks in, because having gone through the campaign and like all the horrific things that were revealed about him, all the things that he said, all the ways in which he revealed himself to be just unworthy of the office of presidency.
It's hard to remember because it was so disorienting. And I don't only mean the outcome of the presidential election. I don't think that it is only about who is in power and who's not in power. I actually think the thing that was so disorienting was that suddenly the values that I thought made me proud to be an American, values of inclusion and openness, those values didn't seem important anymore.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Water Cooler. I'm Ivani Debery, and I'll be your guide. During this episode, you'll be hearing from the creative team of Shipwreck, as well as other artists and scholars in conversation about the show. In 2017, Anne Washburn went to a silent writing retreat. This was the unruly first year of the Trump administration. Highly charged political discourse permeated practically every conversation.
I had decided before I went to the retreat that whatever had happened in the news, like right before, would be the thing that I would really sort of look at closely. I had made this decision months before. And so that week was the week of Comey's testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee. And as I was in the van to the retreat location, somebody told me, Oscar Eustace is being interviewed by the FBI. It was like this little bit of hot theater gossip.
No, it's the Secret Service. Well, I have to say it was the summer of 2017 that my production of Julius Caesar happened in the park, which was an obvious, ham-handed, sledgehammer-like equation of Julius Caesar with Donald Trump and of the senators who ultimately assassinate him with the progressive wing of American politics.
That's Oscar Eustace, artistic director of the Public Theater, who directed the controversial Shakespeare in the Park production of Julius Caesar.
What I didn't realize is that I was in a new world where the other side was far more expert than we were at taking an image and spinning a fake narrative out of it and making that the subject of attention.
What was your experience reading Shipwreck for the first time?
I was so frightened and shocked and moved by it.
And as the play went on and on, I became utterly fascinated by it. This is important and magnificent and thrilling, and I can't wait to be part of it.
I suppose when I first read it, I did have an oh my fucking God moment.
That was Jeannie O'Hare, former director of New Work Development at the Public Theater.
It was one of those plays, occasionally you read a play, and I like reading plays on paper. I had to put it down and walk around my office and then sit down again and read it again. So it's one of those plays. It had a big impact on me.
Sahim Ali has been struck by the play's evolving and deepening significance.
This play has taken on such extraordinary resonance every time that it's been performed. There was a production in London that happened during Brexit, and so that conversation was very, very much affected by the sense of upheaval that the UK was going through at that time.
He's talking about Rupert Gould's production at London's Almeida Theatre in February 2019.
We're dealing with the complete disaster of the paralysis of the post-Brexit referendum. So I was really drawn to Shipwreck as a story predominantly about people my age, which I know is sort of narcissistic, but I think it was I was very curious about what it meant to be at that stage of life politically, both in terms of what my generation had grown up through politically, but also what it means to be at that point when you are, you know, maybe thinking about family or property or all those things in a very idiosyncratic way. So I was very drawn to that.
At the time, there was no shortage of comparisons between the political landscapes in the UK and US. Two leaders rising to power on platforms fueled by anti-immigrant, anti-establishment rhetoric striking a specific, fearful chord with roughly half of the voting population.
Boris is becoming less of a figure of fun than he was through COVID. But he has this sort of innate buffoonishness. And maybe there were sort of parallels with Boris and Trump in the play a bit that the audience sort of enjoyed and picked up on. I think now Trump is perceived with much more fear and anxiety over here.
You know, I'm speaking as a Brit, and it is a very, very American play. It explores the minutiae of how an American liberal can atomize an argument, to the point where the drive to action is taken out of the argument. What is the relationship between knowing something ought to be done and actually doing it?
We jump forward a year to January 2020, where rehearsals are taking place for the American premiere at Woolly Mammoth Theater Company in Washington, D.C. Artistic director Maria Manuela Goyanes felt compelled by how the play would resonate in the nation's capital.
It's an election year, and we're in Washington, D.C. Everything was gearing up to the election. Folks had already been thrown their hat into the ring.
When we did it in D.C., it was during the impeachment.
Donald Trump had just been impeached. So it was a wild moment to be making this play in Washington, D.C.
That was dramaturg Sarah Lunny, who worked on the Woolly Mammoth and Public Theater co-production.
And over the course of our rehearsal process, the Senate blocked witnesses in the impeachment trial.
We were engaged in a play that was about the beginning of a sort of like what we was hoping was an unraveling, right? Like here we were again, hoping for this is the thing, this is it. Just like in 2017.
The country did not erupt into protests and the world kept spinning. And Anne wrote a new line in the play.
Mitch McConnell steals a Supreme Court justice? We're not in the streets. And if in the future the Republican-controlled Senate blocks all principal witnesses from some sham of an impeachment trial, you won't see us in the streets.
Initially, the co-production between Woolly Mammoth and the public was to culminate in a physically realized production in the fall of 2020. In adapting the play for audio, change of medium wasn't the sole consideration. Anne also contemplated the moment. Much like previous incarnations, this third iteration of Shipwreck lands at a time of incredible uncertainty. We're headed into the most contentious presidential election of many of our lifetimes. We are months into a global pandemic. Since this summer, the streets have been ablaze with thousands of demonstrations nationwide demanding racial justice. What follows are selections of Anne in dialogue with several thinkers on language, politics, and identity. In a moment, we'll hear her in dialogue with fellow playwright Will Arbery. Later, we meet John McWhorter for a linguist's perspective on how language both helps us and prevents us from communicating.
We no longer have a common language to discuss politics. We have all these different languages. We need to be able to speak to each other.
And finally, we'll learn of Anne's decision to cut a major character, Mark, and reimagine the play without him. We'll hear from Anne, her collaborators, as well as from scholar Kwame Anthony Appiah about the nature and implications of the change.
And then the pandemic hit, and we talked about making it into an audio play. And then George Floyd was murdered in Minneapolis, and this huge discussion blossoming. So the discussion really became about could the play have this, could we do this play with this character, A, written by a white playwright, and then B, is this a time for anyone to be writing a play in which a Black character is unpacking racial trauma in this particular way?
Throughout, we will continue to hear from actors in the audio production and others who were instrumental along the way. First up, Anne chats with fellow playwright Will Arbery on crafting characters who sit on the other side of the political aisle.
I thought it might be very interesting to discuss what it is to write a play with characters who have political ideologies which are not your own, and to ensure them humanity and eloquence, and how that's a challenge, both as a person with certain viewpoints and as a writer, just the mechanics of what it is to write those characters. Is that different for you than writing people who to whom you more easily ideologically conform?
I come from a world of people whose beliefs are different from my own. Intensely brilliant, intellectual, passionate people. It's a world that I know well, and like resulted in certainly my play Heroes of the Fourth Turning, but also has infused pretty much everything I write.
Heroes of the Fourth Turning, Will Arbery's Pulitzer Prize nominated play, premiered at Playwrights Horizons in September 2019. Like Shipwreck, Heroes is set in 2017.
It's about these four graduates of this tiny Catholic Great Books College in the middle of Wyoming, and they've returned to see their professor named president of the college, and they're sort of sitting around drunk waiting for her to show up. I think that when it came to actually writing it, it just became about letting these characters take over. And any time that I felt my self slipping in there, sort of imposing some sort of authorial agenda on things, I would try to strip those moments away. I wanted to let these characters and all of, because Heroes takes place with no liberal voices present, it was important that those characters felt safe, you know, and were saying things to each other that they might not say, even if I was there. So I had to get out of the way.
We need to absolutely know the most private, most eloquent arguments of the political side that we are not personally attached to, because it's only in that way, well, A, that we can speak with each other productively, or B, that we can argue with each other tactically, argue with each other persuasively. And I do feel when you talk about the liberal bubble, we're very, very insulated from the most eloquent part of other people's arguments. Did you worry about their eloquence? Did you worry that they were persuasive?
I think I was less worried about persuading people, because I think that might have actually been something that I was unconsciously striving for. Like, if they're not persuasive, then they're not going to be, then I will have failed to some degree. Like, they need to be compellingly, compellingly thoughtful people. I actually need them to be persuasive. I need there to be tickles of danger in the audience's mind when they sort of realize, oh, that was well said, or I never thought about it that way. That's definitely part of the provocation of the play. I think what I was more worried about was alienating people. I didn't want people to feel attacked by the play, even if I was trying to tell the truth about certain, you know, at times like hateful things that might be said behind closed doors. You know, I think I was especially worried about alienating, you know, people of color, or queer people, you know, or immigrants. You know, I wasn't that worried about alienating like white liberal New Yorkers. That was actually like sort of, I was sort of hoping that there was a degree of that, of sort of like putting whiteness under the microscope and sort of implicating white people in a way that they're not used to.
By complicating views about the other side, Anne and Will force audiences to confront their own idiosyncratic behaviors in safe settings.
This play is sort of, their home is like metaphorically a safe space.
But it really doesn't turn out to be that. It's gets really contentious. It feels like a lot of relationships fracture by the end of the play. Who knows if there's like any coming back from this? And I think about how people in my life that I know communicate to people who are politically different.
You know, all these questions that a lot of liberals are faced with right now, certainly a huge discomfort talking about race, certainly a huge discomfort when you actually talk about what is an acceptable or a possible or hopeful way to change this country, how that change happens and how revolutionary it should be. You know, so many questions that until you start talking about, liberals would sort of say we're all on the same page, but in reality, people are on very different pages, and those questions, when articulated, can, you know, fray friendships that, you know, have a lot of history.
That was Mia Barron again, along with Soo Jin Kim. As cast members, their charge was to dive into these sprawling issues of race and politics. Here are fellow actors Joe Morton and Raul Esparza.
Luis is a character who stands outside that conversation, and his curiosity, it feels insidious, because he is constantly poking at something that is uncomfortable for everybody else in the room.
What this play does is it talks about liberalism in a fairly full way. I mean, a comprehensive way, because there are so many different kinds of liberals. It's not just, you know, it's just like conservatives. There's lots of different kinds of conservatives. There is no monolithic, this is what a liberal is.
What are the ramifications for a country when our most honest rhetoric exists primarily within the confines of one's political bubble? What does that mean for discourse, for debate? Here's Anne in conversation with John McWhorter, Columbia University scholar, linguist, and author.
If we are in a time right now, which is a time of multiple crisis, a divided nation, and where it feels like so many groups have such their own sets of language, where Trump is able to give whole long speeches, which appear to be normal and using normal language. But if you're keyed into alt-right signifiers, he's conducting an entire separate conversation underneath it, which people may or may not be attuned to because we no longer have a common language to discuss politics. We have all these different languages. We desperately need to be able to speak to each other. I don't know. Is there some way in which language structure could be this thing that saves us?
You could imagine something happening that where the left and the right break everything down and bring up a new political ideal from the ashes that they created by breaking everything down. The thing that worries me is that we have a severe problem on both sides, where we have a right wing that is anti-empirical and anti-scientific. And so they're not talking about real things anymore, right down to the trickle-down economics they won't let go of. But then we have a hard left, which has become especially influential, I think, after social media settled in. And that really kicks in about 2012. And it's this particular radical ideology that I'm mentioning. And I don't mean radical as a slam, but just the idea that there needs to be some profound upending of general procedure, including what we think of as intelligence, what we think of as morality. So we would need a whole new way of looking at things, and that would even include language. So yeah, it's nice to imagine that, to take everything, break it down, and look at categories and procedures and phenomena in new ways and have new labels. That happens very slowly in real life, but it is where one needs to go.
I'm thinking a lot about the construct which white liberals use to not talk about race and what a particular structure it is. And so I really just wanted to ask you, what is that to have a language structure which is about non-communication rather than communication?
I think that what we have to always understand, and I think you certainly understand this because you write characters, using language, is that making statements about what's around us is a very small part of what language is for. Just as often, we're not making statements about what's going on around us. We are establishing whether or not we feel the same way about things. That's part of being a social person. Language is a social tool. So an awful lot of what we say certainly rubs nouns and verbs together, but what we're actually doing is making sure that everything is okay and that there isn't about to be any kind of social stress. And so that's why many people in many cultures are uncomfortable ever being completely silent. It's why people do things like go, yeah, you know, when there's nothing to give assent to, or why many people will kind of smack their thighs, you know, that kind of gesture, bam. Why are you hitting your legs? Because nobody's saying anything, and that establishes that everything's okay. It's called phatic communication, P-H-A-T-I-C. And that phatic communication actually can extend to a desire to establish that everybody has the same moral views or political views. And so my sense of the way a certain crowd, of which I would consider myself a part, and you probably do too, that group of people are very committed to establishing that they are enlightened about race issues and that they're not racist. And I completely understand that. And so I think that often when the non-Black crowd talk about race, as you're putting it, it's not really so much that anybody's waiting for any new insight. It's that everybody wants to make sure that everyone in the room has a certain basic understanding that it is wrong to look down on other groups of people. And so to the extent that you might feel like people are not talking about it, maybe what you're saying is that people aren't saying anything new or they aren't proposing solutions. And so you end up having not real conversations where you pretend to espouse things that maybe you would rather not try to think all the way through. But doing that is at least acknowledging that you know there's a problem. So it ends up being something that doesn't feel like conversation. It can feel messy. It can seem performative, I would think. But what it's really doing is it's making social interaction graceful in the way that language always does, no matter what the topics in the air are. So there's a lot of etiquette about in the way we talk about race.
But isn't there that always the challenge of etiquette, that on the one hand, it's crucial? I guess... Yeah, that sense of when does courtesy become, when does attentive courtesy become hollow ceremony? And at what point does hollow ceremony become something which, I don't know, everyone loses patience with or which can no longer be sustained? I think any learning situation is a combination of shame and love, right? So I think similarly, if we're going to actually have conversations, if we're actually going to expand vocabulary, which I genuinely think is happening. I know that, for example, my particular white liberal brain has gone to places I didn't know it could go. There are intricacies I didn't know that I could perceive, and it's a relief to perceive. And I think that that's happened out of a curious combination of love and shame. And whether the shame factor is too high or the love factor, you know, the permissive love factor is too high, like you're never going to hit the right mix, just as no language is ever going to attain the perfect self-expression of humans.
Earlier in this episode, we touched on the major changes to Shipwreck leading up to this production.
The original version, the version which debuted in London, went to DC, there's a lead character who is not in this version of the play, a Black man adopted as an infant from Kenya. And placed in a family of white farmers in upstate New York, raised in an all-white community.
One of the reasons I engaged with this play was because of that character, Mark. Like, I loved that Anne was engaging with a character that was outside of her experience in trying to understand something about what it means to be American in this character who hasn't been born here, who is thinking about race and reflecting on race because he's Black in America and he doesn't have the history or the ancestry.
He had a direct relationship with the audience and spoke primarily in long monologues that interspersed the play. And over the course of the play, we come to understand that the folks who have gathered in the farmhouse, the the liberal city people who we are, whose conversation we are following in the farmhouse, are really projections of Marx's imagination.
And then George Floyd was murdered in Minneapolis, and this huge discussion blossoming. So the discussion really became about could the play have this, could we do this play with this character? A, written by a white playwright, and then B, is this a time for anyone to be writing a play in which a Black character is unpacking racial trauma in this particular way?
There's real hurt and real pain and real anger at the inequities that have shown up in this moment and questioning, like, what is privilege? My impulse was not to throw out the baby with the bathwater, not to say we can't do this play simply because you've written this Black character reflecting on slavery and racism. Actually, let's focus the discussion on the politics of the moment. Let's focus the discussion on these white characters who are trying to deal with race and unable to do it. What are we grappling right now with as Americans facing this presidency? What are these white liberals actually, what are the white people in this play actually coming up against? What are the white characters unable to express or unable to find language for?
When Saheem came to me and said, I think there is a play without Mark, and I think it's a different play, I did not believe him. I assured him for a period of, I think, 3 weeks, as I was continuing to adapt it into an audio version, that that was not going to be the case, and we were just going to have to abandon the play altogether. And it was really the last morning before we had to decide this that I had finally made the play with Mark, the satisfactory play. I had come up with the version of it. And then I cut him from the play. And it was weirdly a different play, dramaturgically.
In the original version, in a way, it's his, all of it is his thinking in some deep sense, right? Because he's imagining these people who've the white liberals are in the house that he grew up in. And they're having these conversations and so on.
This is Kwame Anthony Appiah, philosopher, author, and lecturer. Anthony's work mostly focuses on the philosophy of language and mind.
In the end, we discover that the controlling intelligence is the intelligence of this young African-American who's grown up in this white community where this house is. We know that this is a kind of controlling intelligence, and that all these very complicated thoughts are the thoughts of a character. Now, as it were, the play's argument without Mark presupposes the reality of a kind of certain liberal failure to face up to the reality of white supremacy in America.
The thing that was interesting to me, it puts you in a really different relationship to the liberals in the house. And certainly as a white liberal, I entered into this conversation differently because I didn't have this point of Mark is an overarching narrator. He controls the entire thing ultimately.
And if Mark were there, there would be the possibility of responding by saying, well, that's just Mark's claim about people. All right. Whereas now, if we trust the play, we have to face the thought that, there really might be people like this. In fact, we know some of them. And this might be a real problem that we can't put off by suggesting that it's the result of a failure of interpretation on the part of an imaginary intelligence, the Marx imaginary intelligence. So that's one way in which I think it makes it more directly. I mean, it's not that that other set of questions isn't fantastically interesting. As I say, I think it is fantastically interesting. But now the question is, as a reader, I'm thinking, I'm being invited to a diagnosis of a problem, right? And so my challenge is to decide whether I agree with the diagnosis and whether the play makes a convincing case for the diagnosis. And I think it does.
I'm the last person to weigh in on that.
That's because you were the first person.
Right. I've had my fun.
What I am struck by now when I experience the new draft from which Mark has been removed is that I didn't know in the previous incarnation the extent to which, as a white person watching that play, Mark framing the scenes with those well-meaning urban dwelling liberal people in that farmhouse, those scenes being mediated through the mind of Mark, I think gave me a way to distance myself from those conversations, particularly when I began to see them through his critical gaze. You know, I had the tendency to want to align myself with him and think of myself as being in the know and seeing the problem. With Mark gone, you know, my relationship to those scenes is sort of like a valence closer. Then there's more of an immediacy to it. Now it really feels like the motor of the play is a community of non-Black, liberal-identifying people being forced to reckon with their own assumptions and to confront their own responsibility for the situation in which we find ourselves in a more immediate way.
I understood, especially, and Anne and I in our conversations understood that this is something to reckon with. And are we actually helping or hurting the conversation by hurling forward? And what Anne has done is, as is going to publish these two plays side by side, and to have the DC London version and this radio version, and an essay in which she talks about just the thinking that went into the decision.
And at this particular historical moment, what Anne came to believe, and I came to believe others, Saeem Ali, who directed it, that we don't need a white person narrating the experience of a Black character, and particularly their experience about race. That is not a voice that is welcome at this moment. And that's what I want to make clear is I don't think that's censorship. I don't think that's fear. I think that's respect.
The question isn't whether it's right or wrong to have written it any particular way or to have done it any particular way in the past. The question is a question about now and not about the morality of playwriting. It's about why in the present moment we feel that that character can't be there. And I mean, there's also this interesting dramaturgical issue, which is that it works extremely well as well, though in a different way, without him. But why can't he be there anymore? Well, we're at a moment of reckoning about race in American theater. So I think that is an interesting question that the history of the plays, performances, and productions raises.
When we last heard from Jeanie O'Hare, she posed the critical question, what is the relationship between knowing something ought to be done and actually doing it? Could it be that we confuse the desire for action, the knowledge that action is necessary, with the act itself?
We quite often construct these lives in which we're insulated from ever having to take actions and make decisions about what's going on around us in politics. And you can see it very, very clearly, but you teach yourself to be willfully blind to it. And so I do think that there's an element of liberalism which has spun off into that kind of cocoon of inaction. So taking it back to drama, you know, Aristotle and his theories on drama, character is action. What you do is who you are. And if you are endlessly talking about doing something and never doing it, that's who you are. You are complacent and inactive, and you're actually apolitical because you're not doing anything. So character is action. That is what makes drama work. It actually ought to be what makes politics work too.
I think what Anne Washburn is doing in this play is indicting herself and her friends. She is really deeply investigating what is that feeling that is making her, you know, be unable to enact real change as a citizen of this country. And why does she feel so helpless in this moment? And why do her friends feel so helpless? Why is that so difficult?
the thing that I related to most, I think, was this sense that I had, that these characters feel like they have been part of a rational political discourse in which they understand their place in the world, and they understand who the enemies are, they understand who their friends are, they understand the terms of engagement of the struggle. And then Trump throws that all off. And it's not just Trump, it's what Trump's election reveals about the country.
And it gives you an insight into, yes, the ways we blind ourselves and the ways we speak about things and the ways we don't take responsibility for what our words mean and the actions that are implied that we think we've taken simply because we've spoken.
And I think that's what I worry about with the liberals. And I think that might be part of the mirror. When does it stop being, when do you have to stop engaging it on an academic level and then start doing something practical? I think a lot about action. Allie, the character Allie, has a big moment where she says, no one's doing anything. And they're like, what did you do? And she said, I made phone calls. And is that the extent of our political power? Is there more we can be doing? Is there more we should be doing?
Shipwreck is subtitled A History Play About 2017. It examines the recent yet seemingly distant past as historical, events to be considered in juxtaposition to the densely packed events of the 3 years since and the social apathy that fermented political complacency. First, in London.
I guess 2018, moving late into 2018, we're dealing with the complete disaster of the paralysis of the post-Brexit referendum. And many of the issues that the characters in Shipwreck talk about, not the issues, maybe the sort of identity of those issues, resonated very deeply, I think, with what particularly metropolitan liberals of the kind that one associates, rightly or wrongly, with my theatre, also were fretting about, because I think they had been complacent about the Brexit vote and complacent about the rise of populism and nationalism and national self-identity.
Then, at the proverbial scene of the crime, Washington, D.C.
We were rehearsing in D.C. in the middle of the impeachment hearings, and I remember that the week John Bolton was scheduled to come testify before the Senate and then was blocked from testifying was the week we were working on what felt like all week. I'm sure it was just a day or part of a day. We were working on the scene where, among other things, Allie talks about her, how during the Merrick Garland hearings, we should have been in the streets. We should have been out in the streets. We should have protested. We should have done something. And she didn't do anything. And all during that week, we're watching this scene and we're following the news. And it wasn't until the very end of the week, when all of it was over, that it occurred to me that this entire time, there we were, four blocks away from the Capitol. And not once during this entire week had it even occurred to me to trot over on the lunch break, you know, with a sign, or even to go there and just stand and glare. It hadn't occurred to me.
And finally, to October 16th, 2020.
There have been these moments when history has come to the forefront because it relates so specifically to what is happening. And here we are now again in you know, October of 2020, and we are weeks away from the election, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg has just passed away. And we're talking about the Supreme Court. And in the play, you know, the liberals talk about Merrick Garland and why did we just roll over? Like, why did we accept? And Mitch McConnell says, like, you know, the people decide. He's not saying that now.
In an interview with the New York Times preceding the world premiere of Shipwreck, Anne mused, what is it like to put this time on paper? She sought to capture the intricate, heated conversation and non-conversation of this moment. How we desperately reach for consensus or for conclusion and fall short, or fall flat, or overreach. Anne's play concerns itself with nothing less than the making of history. The confusion of knowing you are inside a pivotal moment, but not having any perspective on it, not knowing what you might be missing or how it will turn out. obsessed with the question of how you, even this very moment, through your action or inaction, are affecting the outcome. And so we stand in the calm before the storm, looking around, surveying the landscape before plunging into another unknown. And the ever-present question, will we act? I'm Ivani Debery. Thank you for joining us.